and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 4th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, possible clues to sudden infant death syndrome, the first Mercury flyby in 33 years, preserving Iraqi antiquities. Science Careers bids a fond farewell to the educated woman columnist and a call for a new federal science agency in the United States. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, is the leading cause of death in the post-neonatal period of children in developed countries. Scientists are not sure what causes SIDS, but postmortem studies of infants who die from SIDS show alterations in the serotonin neurons in the brainstem. In a paper in this week's Science, Cornelius Gross and colleagues report their findings with a mouse model that deficient serotonin regulation is enough to cause death. I spoke with Gross from his office at the European Molecular Biology Laboratory in Monterotondo, Italy.
In human sudden infant death syndrome, there has been a large body of work showing that these infants have deficits or alterations in the serotonin system in the brainstem, and that is thought now, it's the prevailing hypothesis for possibly why these kids die suddenly. And so there may be some link between why our mice die and why humans die who have abnormalities in the serotonin system.
What's known about the serotonin's role in sudden infant death syndrome?
The main evidence is anatomical. So there have been a series of postmortem studies. They come mainly from the lab of Hannah Kinney at Harvard. And what she found was a doubling in the number of serotonin cells and a change in the levels of some of the receptors that are involved in homeostatic control. And those differences were not found in control babies who died of non-SIDS causes. So the assumption is that those deficits have something to do with why they died. But obviously, what they don't know yet is what really is wrong with the serotonin system. They can try to make some guesses, but the functionality is not known. It's mainly these markers, these anatomical markers that are altered.
What do normal levels of serotonin neuron firing do?
It's something that is quite controversial. One of the findings in the animal field is that you can remove serotonin completely. So there are mice that have been produced which, in fact, have no or very, very little serotonin cells and therefore very little serotonin, and they're viable and they survive to adulthood and they have some behavioral differences, but they don't die. So there was something special that we did to these mice, to the serotonin system, that make them die. So it's not clear exactly. It appears to be a modulatory system, and these cells in the medulla, these serotonin cells, they project to regions of the brainstem, which are known to control essentially sympathetic tone, which is part of the autonomic system that drives the body temperature changes and heart rate and so forth. So it's thought to be a kind of a critical portion of a feedback loop. But it's quite controversial exactly what it does, and I think that's also why these mice we've made have attractive attention, because I don't think people realize serotonin was so crucial, let's say.
Tell us a little bit more about those mice. What did your team do to investigate the alterations of serotonin neuron firing?
So we increased the levels of the expression of this serotonin receptor in serotonin neurons. And this is a receptor which is responsible for negative feedback. So serotonin is released locally. It binds to this receptor, which is located on the same cells that produce the serotonin. And it leads to a decrease in their firing rate and therefore release in serotonin. So by increasing the levels of this receptor, we expected to decrease serotonin firing rate and the release of serotonin. And in fact, when we looked at levels of serotonin in the brain, we found that there was a reduction in what is called serotonin turnover, which is a measure of the level of the metabolite to serotonin. The decrease was not actually as large as we'd expected. So the decrease is about 20% to 30%, and that was considered relatively mild. So that's certainly compatible with life. And the other thing we did was to record the electrical activity of serotonin neurons and show, in fact, that they responded more strongly to serotonin when serotonin is released by decreasing their firing activity. So that was all consistent with what we had done, which was to increase the level of this receptor.
So what happened to the mice that overexpressed this receptor?
So the mice that overexpress the receptor appear normal. They have gained body weight normally. They're born in the normal ratio of animals. And what we found was that between 50 and 70 or 80% of the animals died. And this happened sporadically and started at about postnatal day 21. That's the time when mice are removed from their mothers, so they're weaned and they start to live independently. And essentially went on, this death went on to about postnatal day 80 or 90 or 100, which is when animals reach maturity or adulthood. So when we looked then more carefully to find out what was occurring just before the death to try to essentially watch what was happening, the first thing we found was that their body temperature was dramatically lowered. And whenever we saw a death of an animal, we always found a drop in body temperature before. And we also saw at the same time a drop in the heart rate of the animals, which is called bradycardia, which was also dramatic, up to 50% drop in heart rate. We also found crises, which is the term I use to describe the drop in body temperature and heart rate. We also found these crises that occurred independently of death. So it wasn't just that the animals were about to die and therefore the whole system was running down. It appeared that they had these crises, and sometimes the crises led to death, and sometimes the animal was able to recover.
Now, you said these were sporadic. Was there something environmental that triggered these autonomic crises of decreased heart rate and body temperature?
Yes, so we haven't been able, we obviously thought along the same lines. I mean, that's a great question, and we have not been able to find anything. We tried a number of different environmental stressors, including temperature. We also tried a number of pharmacological challenges, and we have not yet been able to find anything that induces the crises to occur. So we actually know very little about why the crises occur when they do.
Anything that could be done to treat these mice with this overexpressed autoreceptor and prevent death?
So yes, there are two things that we did which prevented the crises. One is that we treated the animals with a drug which blocks the receptor which we overexpressed. And as you might expect, the animals then did not enter into the crises. And the second thing we did is we treated the animals with a drug which is able to also block the expression of the receptor. And that's, in this case, an antibiotic. And I should point out, however, that this antibiotic is something that only works in our transgenic animals because we have engineered these animals to express this receptor under a bacterial transcription factor which can be blocked with this antibiotic. So this is something that clearly has no relevance whatsoever to the human condition or even to SIDS, for example.
So then it's not the levels of serotonin, it's the number of these serotonin receptors that are associated with this decreased heart rate and body temperature?
Well, yes. The presence of this excess serotonin 1A receptor on serotonin neurons appears to be sufficient to induce these crises.
So does this research then suggest a way to detect which infants may be susceptible to sudden infant death syndrome and, if so, preventing it in them?
Well, I think the first thing you have to remember to, you know, point out is that we don't know what the functional deficits are in the SIDS brains in which people have found these serotonin abnormalities, and we don't know if it has any link or any connection at all with the manipulation we have made. And in fact, it's very unlikely that our animals have the same deficit that is found in SIDS infants. But perhaps there is something about the homeostatic control of serotonin in SIDS brains that is in some way similar to what's happening in our animals. But there is no evidence that the functional changes in SIDS in our animals is similar at this point, at least. And maybe since I'm not a clinician, it's difficult for me to answer the question about whether this information could be helpful in diagnosing SIDS. And it might lead clinicians to look for maybe some other markers. For example, much of the SIDS field is focused on respiratory deficits because those really are a very likely source of autonomic deficits that could lead to death. But less attention has been paid to other sympathetic systems like temperature and so on. So it might give them some ideas to look at other deficits in other sympathetic systems. And it might lead them to try to ask whether there is a change in the function of the serotonin system that includes a deficient or enhanced autoregulatory feedback.
Cornelius Gross, thank you very much.
Okay.
Cornelius Gross is senior author of a paper on the dysregulation and death associated with excessive serotonin autoinhibition. Read the paper in this week's Science. It's been 33 years since Mariner 10 became the first spacecraft to fly by the planet Mercury. It was also the last spacecraft to fly by Mercury until this February. In 11 papers in this week's Science, Sean Solomon and colleagues report the data from the MESSENGER spacecraft's first flyby of the planet including pictures of parts of the planet that have never been seen before, as well as information about the planet's surface, space environment, magnetic field, and geology. The full mission includes 3 flybys and an eventual orbit of the planet scheduled for 2011. I spoke with Solomon at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, here in Washington, D.C.
One of the reasons we're studying the planet Mercury is that it was produced by the same processes and at the same time as our planet Earth. And it had a very different outcome from our planet Earth, as did Mars and Venus, also produced in the same way at the same time. And so in the deepest sense, we're trying to understand how Earth-like planets and planets that turned out very differently from the Earth all evolved by the same processes as our solar system was put together.
Now, Mariner 10 had 3 flybys back in the 1970s.
Yes.
What data was missing that prompted the Messenger mission to Mercury?
Several. Mariner 10 was a terrific mission. It was the first spacecraft ever to get close to Mercury. It discovered the magnetic field. It discovered that Mercury has a tenuous atmosphere. It imaged about half the planet. And the reason that it imaged only half the planet is because every time Mariner 10 flew by Mercury, the same side of the planet was in sunlight. So half the planet was never seen. So one of the reasons we're going is to look at the planet in its entirety. But another reason is to try to figure out what it's made out of, because Mariner 10 carried no instruments that do geochemical remote sensing, and we have several. We want to understand also why Mercury has this magnetic field that Mariner 10 discovered. Little Mercury, smaller than Mars, still has a magnetic field today, and so we want to answer that question. And even since Mariner 10, there have been very important discoveries about Mercury that have raised new questions. For instance, Earth-based radar, a little more than 15 years ago, detected deposits at Mercury's poles that look like there's water ice at the poles. And what's astonishing about that result really is that range in temperature at the equator between day and night is 600 degrees centigrade, 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. So how do you keep ice at the poles? And the answer is that these radar deposits are confined to the floors of impact craters very near the poles. And Mercury's spin axis has almost no tilt from the perpendicular to its orbital plane, which means that an impact crater is in permanent shadow. And the atmosphere is so thin that if you're in permanent shadow, you're looking out into black space. And it's very cold. It's like nighttime on Mercury all the time. And the temperatures are like 90 degrees Kelvin. You can freeze ice out and keep it frozen for a billion years. So there's mysteries that have been discovered, even since Mariner 10, that compel us to go back to Mercury.
Now, this report is one of 11 reports in this week's Science about data from Messenger's first flyby. Has any of the data already gathered by Messenger altered the understanding of Mercury?
Oh, in a number of ways.
Or confirmations. I mean, those are important, too.
Well, sure. We did all those things. We made some new kinds of measurements of Mercury's atmosphere. We measured some of the ionized species in Mercury's atmosphere for the first time. We made another pass through Mercury's magnetic field. We imaged more than 20% of the planet that had never been seen by spacecraft before. So we were seeing Terra Incognita before January. We took some of the very first high spectral resolution measurements of the reflected light in visible and near-infrared and ultraviolet wavelengths from Mercury's surface, and that's diagnostic of the composition of the materials. So we made a whole suite of measurements. Recognize that this flyby is really not the main part of the mission. The flyby helps us on our trajectory toward ultimately going into orbit around Mercury in 2011. And this is the first of 3 flybys.
So based on the data thus far from both Mariner 10 and the first flyby by Messenger and these polar deposits, do you have a good idea of the history of Mercury that might help us understand better the formation of Earth and the rest of the solar system?
We have some important hints, but at the same time, the history is going to be a difficult question to answer fully. And that's why we're going into orbit, because we need the orbital phase of the mission to get the global view and to do much better analysis of the chemistry of what Mercury is made of. Because we think the chemistry has very important clues into how all of the inner planets got put together. Flyby is very tough to get after the chemical question. Nonetheless, we already know that a lot of the surface material of Mercury is the product of internal volcanic activity. That's been a debate since Mariner 10, because it wasn't clear from the resolution of the images that Mariner 10 was able to obtain that the smooth planes on Mercury are frozen volcanic flows. Messenger obtained higher resolution images, multi-spectral images that point toward volcanic sources for a lot of those planes. Mariner 10 did tell us that Mercury has some very unusual fault structures that make it different from all the other planets, in that every place that Mariner 10 took an image, the dominant fault structure was one produced by contraction of the surface, by shortening of the surface. And the Mariner 10 team conjectured that when we were able to look at the rest of the surface, the 55% that Mariner 10 did not see, that we would also see these contractional faults. And at least in our flyby in January, that is indeed what we saw. So that prediction was borne out. And it means that, assuming that when we finish the inventory of looking at the planet globally, that Mercury shrunk, that it contracted by a sufficient amount over its history as a result of cooling of the inside, and particularly cooling of the core where the magnetic field is generated, that the stresses built up by that contraction were large enough to make faults throughout the surface of the kind that we see on the Earth only when great blocks of the crust are thrust against one another. So the amount of shrinkage is greater. A conservative estimate is at least a third greater than what Mariner 10 saw, but that number is going to go up as we get more images at different lighting conditions on a global basis. So not only is this the incredible shrinking planet, but that shrinkage was greater than we anticipated, and that shrinkage is going to be a very important constraint on when and by how much the planet cooled and how much of that internal heat in the core could have been converted into the kind of energy needed to sustain a magnetic field. And that, in turn, is going to help us with the question of why there's a magnetic field today and what are the characteristics of that field. So it's an interesting planet where understanding the geological history, and particularly the history of fault formation, has a very direct link to understanding how a magnetic field is generated.
Is there anything about the planet that people who aren't planetary geologists might be surprised to learn about?
One of the things that we have gained in appreciation about Mercury from just this flyby is how dynamic a place it is today. I mean, it looks like a very ancient surface. It's got craters everywhere you look. It's very dense because not very far down from the surface is this huge iron core. But what surprised us is the level of interaction between the magnetic field produced by processes in that core and the energetic particles that are streaming out from the sun, the solar wind. And they interact with this magnetosphere, this envelope that surrounds Mercury, much like the envelope that surrounds the Earth and protects us from charged particles from the sun and to some extent from cosmic rays, and without which we'd be bombarded by a lot more radiation than we are. Well, Mercury's got a miniature version of Earth's magnetosphere, but it's extremely changeable, extremely dynamic. And in fact, the charged particles from the sun sometimes, it looks like, impact directly on Mercury's surface. And as they do, they change the color and the character of the surface. They eject material into Mercury's neutral atmosphere. They ionize some of the atoms in that atmosphere. So as we flew by, it was a very quiet time. The sun was being very quiet, but there was still a lot going on. We measured a whole range of ionized species as we flew by with our fast imaging plasma spectrometer. But once we're in orbit, not only will we see the regular changes having to do with variations in time of day, variations in distance from the sun, Mercury's in a very eccentric orbit, but the sun's going to be a lot more active when we get into orbit than it is now. So we expect to see even a greater range of dynamic phenomena than we saw in January.
Sean Solomon is principal investigator of the MESSENGER mission to Mercury. You can read more about it in this week's Science. During the invasion of Iraq in 2003, there were many reports of looting, both at museums and archaeological sites around the country. Now, 5 years into the occupation, Science news writer Andrew Lawler reports that the ongoing presence of soldiers has had its share of problems for Iraqi antiquities. But a team of archaeologists returning from southern Iraq bears surprisingly good news. Lawler writes about it in this week's issue.
In 2003, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, there had been some thought given to the country's archaeological heritage, but really not much. Iraq, as some people may know, is the place where the first civilizations and the first writing systems and the first empires developed in human history. So it's exceedingly important for archaeologists. But when the troops arrived, there wasn't a lot of information that the military had given out to commanders and soldiers about the nature of Iraq's heritage. And as a result, we saw the Iraq Museum looted, we saw archaeological sites devastated, and a period of chaos that ensued after the invasion, which was certainly bad news for archaeologists and Iraq's archaeology.
What about since then? Have the troops been mindful of the archaeological sites?
Well, no, this has been a problem. You know, although there's been some progress in educating the military about the nature of these archaeological sites and artifacts, there had been problems. For example, at Babylon, the Americans and then the Polish had a base. They bulldozed several sites there at Babylon, which was in a very important ancient capital, one of the most important cities of the ancient world, where Alexander the Great died. Nebuchadnezzar ruled, and all sorts of things happened over thousands of years. There was some pretty severe damage at spots there at Babylon, which was detailed in a report by British archaeologist John Curtis, who went there and did a report. And also, there's been damage at a couple of other sites, including Ur, which is the legendary home of Abraham. There's an American Air Force base, which has been built. I witnessed the construction of it back in May of 2003. And a team that has just returned from Iraq reports that there is damage there as well. So it's still a problem.
What about rebuilding efforts? Have those endangered any sites?
Yes, there have been attempts by developers, particularly in southern Iraq, in the town of Nasiriyah, for example, to do things like ordinary things like build brick factories. Now, you think that that's a good sign in Iraq that they want to build brick factories in order to build buildings. But trouble was, in the case of Nasiriyah, they wanted to build these brick factories on top of an unexcavated archaeological site that is apparently of some importance. There was an Iraqi archaeologist, Abdel Amir Hamdani, who objected and said, no, you can't do that. It's against Iraqi law to build a factory on an archaeology site. And there was quite a to-do, and he eventually was thrown in jail by his enemies on the town council of Nasiriyah. He eventually was released after several months in prison, but his life was certainly in danger, but he refused to bend, and the brick factories were in fact not built there. So that's one of the few really good news stories that we can point to, where our archaeology sites have actually been protected despite attempts by developers as well as looters.
To what extent has looting been a problem?
Well, looting is, it's been very difficult to know what's going on in Iraq. I was there in May of 2003 with a team of archaeologists. That was one of the last teams that was allowed into the country to do an independent analysis of the state of archaeology sites. What we did know from remote sensing data and from a few people like Hamdani, I mentioned before, reports coming from him, but only sporadically, was that there was massive looting that took place after the war began. So from April of 2003 until at least the fall of 2003, we know that sites all over, particularly southern Iraq, were devastated. But we haven't known exactly how bad the damage was until just a few weeks ago, about mid-June, when a team of independent archaeologists went to Iraq with the help of the British government, the British military, who provided security and transportation. And these archaeologists, Iraqi, American, English, German, they went and actually visited about five important sites in southern Iraq to determine what the status was. Now, they were not able to visit any very small sites in Iraq because of the lack of time and security. So it's still an unknown. But one of the archaeologists, Elizabeth Stone, at the University of New York at Stony Brook, has done good work in finding satellite images which show before and after, that is, before the war and then after the war, what exactly took place, particularly in 2003. And what's clear is that there was massive looting at the smaller sites. So although the larger sites seem to be in pretty good shape, that is, for example, Uruk, which is the legendary home of King Gilgamesh and where writing was first invented, that's in a pretty good situation. The Germans who have dug there have paid for a guard, and there are also guards from the Iraqi government who have been protecting that site. So that's in good shape, and that's very good news. We don't know the situation in detail about these smaller sites, which the evidence indicates are probably in a pretty bad state.
Because archaeologists aren't working in the area now, what can they do, if anything, remotely to continue their work?
Well, that's the silver lining here, and it's a little bittersweet, but the situation in Iraq has forced archaeologists to find other ways to do their research. Obviously, at this point, they cannot go and dig, although some are hopeful that in the next couple of years, 2 or 3 years maybe, it might be possible in a limited way to go back and do a little bit of work at some sites like Uruk. But for the most part, they have to look from a distance. And Elizabeth Stone has really been leading the way in finding these remote sensing images and really trying to pull together a database that can provide information about the nature of settlement patterns in Mesopotamia. How big were the houses? How did they vary in size? You know, exactly how were these places laid out? These are some fundamental questions which, to a large extent, have not been answered despite 100 years of Mesopotamian archaeology. So this is forcing archaeologists to find new data and, as a result, to find new ways to look at Mesopotamian life. So it's a, as I say, it's a little bit of a bittersweet silver lining, but it's something which certainly could prepare archaeologists who work in Mesopotamia for the next era of archaeology.
Well, are archaeologists able to study the artifacts that are coming out of the country anyway through these looting or over the black market or something like that? Or do they need to find these artifacts in place in order to make sense of them?
Well, this is a very good and a very controversial question. You would think that if an artifact is taken out of the ground and brought to New York and sold, well, why couldn't it be studied by scholars? There are some scholars who say you can do that. Those tend to be people who are called Assyriologists, that is, people who read cuneiform tablets, the ancient writing of Mesopotamia. As far as many of them are concerned, the data is contained on the tablet, and where it was found is secondary. So they're interested in what the tablet says, and they tend not to ask too many questions about where it came from. Archaeologists, on the other hand, tend to have a much more stringent view, and that is, if we don't know where an object came from, then we don't know, number one, if it's real or if it's fake. Number two, we don't know what era it's from because we didn't find it in situ, that is, in the ground, where you can judge by the pottery and by carbon dating exactly the date of it. We don't know, you know, where it was found. It may have come from one side of Iraq or the other side of Iraq, or it may have come from Iran or Jordan or Syria. We just don't know. Unless an artifact is found in context, many archaeologists argue they are absolutely worthless as scientific objects because their data is contained in the context in which they're found. And without that context, it doesn't do a scientist any good.
Andrew Lawler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science News writer Andrew Lawler on the preservation of Iraq's battered heritage. Read his article in this week's issue. Since 2002, Mycela Phoenix DeWise has been writing a popular column on the Science Careers website called Educated Woman. The column has chronicled Mycela's journey from her start as a graduate student in science through her postdoc experience. Now, Mycela, which is not her real name, is about to start her next adventure and so is ending her column. I spoke with her via telephone. Please note that we've disguised her voice to help preserve her anonymity.
I started the Educated Woman column in February 2002 because looking at the content on Science Careers, there's a lot of great content about, you know, kind of surface things about careers and how to get new places, but there wasn't really the depth of experience about, you know, a journey through the process. So there's always, you know, kind of how to start and what some of the mechanics of the process are, you know, like choosing an advisor and looking at the mid-career versus the early career versus late career. But there was never that very intimate, very personal day-to-day journey through the life of a research scientist as they are getting their degree. And so it was a great opportunity to divulge very publicly, but anonymously.
Now, when you started this, you didn't necessarily know that you were going to finish going through the process of graduate school.
No, I didn't. There's a little piece of me that thinks that doing the column was one of the things that kept me in graduate school. Like, well, I'm writing about it, and I don't want to be a quitter. And, you know, there was lots of ups and a whole lot more downs, and that's really documented throughout the years that the column has been in existence. You know, there's the disillusionment and disappointment of being a very successful person all the way through undergrad and kind of, you know, you work hard, you achieve, and you follow the rules, and, you know, you get what you need to get. But when you get to graduate school, it's a very different phenomena, and there can be some heartbreak involved when you realize that what you thought you loved doesn't love you back in the same way because it doesn't always give you that same joy that it did, especially when you're dealing with all of the political situations that can happen in graduate school, the money issues that can happen, the family problems that can arise, all these other things that continue to happen in your life while you are struggling to make it through. I don't know of any person that hasn't had some sort of struggle to make it through graduate school. There are those very few, very lucky ones. And sometimes it really is a matter of luck that you luck up on the right project and you luck up on the right advisor and you luck up on that right piece of equipment or something like that, and everything works beautifully. But I would say 95 to 98% of the time, that is not the case. And me telling my story, which is a very universal story, was very much about what happens that other 98% of the time when everything isn't necessarily going as you thought it would.
Over the years, you've written about everything from choosing your committee and postdoc experiences to even one column, remembering that you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Of all those columns, which is the most memorable to you and why?
Well, out of the columns that have been most memorable were the ones where I incited the most reader response. One of the ones where I was talking about, you know, how to get feedback and where I asked for advice about even whether I should stay in my postdoc or go. You know, a lot of people responded with their own personal experiences. So I would have people who used to be professors write me and tell me, you know, I did this. I was a professor for X number of years and I got out of it. I'm doing something else and I could never be more happy. Or other people who are like, you know, I'm a professor. I love it. You know, I stuck with it through the hard times and, you know, this is what I was called to do. So there was this wide variation of responses that I would receive to a lot of the things that I would write.
Is that how you hope it would have helped, affected, inspired, made others cringe even?
I really do hope that everything that I wrote, you know, for me, it was all very true. I also did pull from some of the experiences of my friends, but I wanted it to be as forthright and truthful about the experience as possible. Because one of the things that I always lamented was that no one could really explain to you what life in research, life in graduate school, life in postdoc land, no one can really explain to you what that is in a nutshell. Because there are all of these hidden things about ourselves and our need to kind of be overachievers and trying to find out how we're going to be the superstar or not. And then really starting to question, well, wait, is this what I want or is this what I should want because everyone else in my environment seems to want this other particular thing? And so it was also a story about kind of finding out what really works for me as opposed to what, quote unquote, should work for me or the role model I should be. Someone will be able to utilize your skills. You will be able to utilize your skills. What is so wrong with stepping outside of the box? And that's always what sciencecareers.org has been about, at least showing those alternatives and being able to step out of the box. But the discussion of how you get to the point of being ready to step outside of the box is not one that's always had. There's always the, oh, okay, this person is outside of the box, but that transitionary, okay, I am a scientist, I am a researcher, I am all of these things, and then how do I make this transition? How do I go from point A to point B? That's not always something that's discussed. And there's a lot of guilt that's involved with that because you've been trained to do a particular thing. And now you don't necessarily want to do that anymore. And being okay with that, making yourself okay with that takes some time.
Speaking of transitions, mm-hmm. you've finished graduate school, finished mm-hmm. a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you leaving this column?
I'm leaving because there's a job out there, but I think it's also the appropriate time to go.
Maybe making room for somebody else to start up
possibly
the educated woman
making
column?
Making room, but the other thing that people used to occasionally write and wonder was, is this, you know, one person or is this like a bunch of editors or who is this? And it's really been me the whole time. But it's time to, you know, move on into a new job that I'm very happy about. But there's nothing that doesn't say that I won't check in every now and then and, you know, wave and say, hi, science careers. I'm still out here. I'm still doing this alternative thing. And I'm really pleased for the experiences that I've been able to share with you.
Any parting words for the readers of your column?
Just to thank them. Thank them for reading. Thank them for writing. Thank them for sharing their stories with me. Because there were people who wrote and just had to unload because they were like, wait, there's somebody else out there who's experiencing the same things that I have experienced. And having the readers write to me also helped me feel like I wasn't alone either. So I want to thank them for that as well.
Mycella Phoenix DeWise, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. It's been great to talk to you. And thank you to all of my readers. It hasn't always been a great ride, but I thank you for taking the journey with me.
Mycella Phoenix DeWise is the author of the Educated Woman column. This week is her last entry. Read it and the entire series at sciencecareers.org.
Former scientists and senior federal officials are proposing that the U.S. government create a new federal agency to monitor the Earth.
Now with a policy update, here's Barbara Jasny, Science Magazine's deputy editor for commentary.
This independent agency might be better able to focus the U.S. government's efforts in monitoring our environment, sponsoring the best research, and providing information to the public and private sectors. In a policy forum in this week's Science, Mark Schaefer and six colleagues argue for a single agency that would merge the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration with the U.S. Geological Survey and incorporate some of the Earth observing done by NASA. I spoke with Schaefer, who is a former official of the Department of the Interior and the U.S. Geological Survey.
The United States is facing major environmental and economic challenges on many fronts, including climate change, the decline of freshwater resources, declines in biodiversity. We're going to have to think about issues of this magnitude at multiple scales, global, national, regional, local. We're going to have to think about these problems from the standpoint of ecosystems. We've got to essentially integrate our research and monitoring activities related to the atmosphere, oceans, freshwater, the terrestrial environment, and the biota. And in order to do this, we're going to have to make some fundamental changes in the way that our federal research and monitoring programs are structured.
So what is the idea behind creating such an agency?
The idea is to bring the ocean and atmospheric elements of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration together with the terrestrial, freshwater, and biological sciences elements of the Geological Survey. Also, it may make sense to bring elements of NASA's Earth Sciences programs into the fold. We're not arguing that we should bring all of NASA's Earth Sciences programs, but selected elements might make sense. And essentially, what you would have now is a coherent Earth System Science Agency that would be able to address the major environmental and natural resource challenges that are facing the nation. Just to give you one example, it doesn't make sense for scientists that are studying climate change and changing rainfall patterns to be in one agency, and scientists studying climate change and its impacts on rivers, streams, and freshwater ecosystems to be in another. We need to bring them together.
Is there some reason to think that a bigger agency will do a better job than what's happening now? Or by combining several agencies, do we risk just creating unnecessary bureaucracy?
Well, there is a precedent for doing this. In the early 1970s, we made the decision to establish a federal environmental protection agency. EPA was essentially formed from a whole series of smaller entities. And the feeling at the time was we need to bring them together to link them effectively and essentially have a critical mass for dealing with the major environmental challenges and regulatory concerns that the U.S. has faced. Over time, the decision to form an environmental protection agency turns out to have made a lot of sense, and today it has become a robust regulatory entity that has proven to be able to deal with a breadth of environmental issues. In fact, we think if there was a Earth System Science Agency with a robust research and monitoring capability, it could make an agency like EPA even more effective.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Mark Schaefer is the lead author on a policy forum that calls for a new Earth System Science Agency. You can read the full proposal in this week's issue of Science.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. If you enjoyed this policy segment and would like to hear more or have other comments about this segment or the podcast itself, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to take a positive trip on hallucinogenic mushrooms. We're going to take a negative stroll through the neurobiology of grief. And finally, we're going to visit a wet and rainy Mars.
Well, let's start off with a positive trip on hallucinogenic mushrooms. What's positive about it?
Well, it turns out quite a bit. This study has to do with research that was done a few years ago with a group of 36 volunteers. And these volunteers were recruited to participate in a lab study whereby they took a strong dose of a chemical called psilocybin. And this is the active ingredient in hallucinogenic mushrooms that were widely used in the 60s and 70s and perhaps even a little bit today. And all the volunteers had a strong spiritual background. So they were either religious, they went to church a lot, or they meditated a lot.
Why did the researchers choose people who were spiritual?
Well, the researchers were interested in the neurobiology of religious experiences. What happens in our brains when, say, we think about God or we meditate? And so they wanted to induce this type of feeling in the lab, and they thought they might be able to do that with this hallucinogenic substance. In addition, all of these volunteers were middle-aged. And in the study that was done a few years ago, the researchers had these volunteers fill out questionnaires right after they had taken the hallucinogenic substance, and also a couple months after. And what these questionnaires showed was that all the volunteers rated this experience they had while on this hallucinogenic substance as highly significant. They frequently described a sense of greater truth or a sense of unity of all things. So a very positive sort of spiritual experience they had while on the hallucinogenic substance.
A controlled experiment in the lab.
That was in the lab. And in the new study, the same team of researchers went back to these volunteers, and this was about 14 months later, and had them fill out the questionnaire again to see if the experience these volunteers had was a long-lasting experience, if it had formed a significant impression in their mind. And believe it or not, even 14 months later, these volunteers rated this experience they had on this hallucinogenic substance among the five most personally and spiritually significant experiences in their entire life.
Now, as middle-aged people, this would include things like having your first child or getting married or something like that.
Exactly. People were ranking this laboratory-induced hallucination right alongside experiences such as having their first child. So it was very significant for a large percentage of them.
Are the researchers planning to do a similar study with non-spiritual people?
Well, that would be the idea. The researchers are trying to figure out what happens in our brain when we have these religious experiences. So a good control, obviously, would be volunteers that are atheists or agnostic that may not have the spiritual background. And it'd be interesting to see, and in fact, the researchers say they're dying to do a study with this group of people to see if they have the same sort of meaningful experience while on the hallucinogenic substance as the people with a religious background did.
Other than this question about whether it makes a difference whether you're religious or not, how else might this research be used?
Well, Rob, there were some studies done in the 1960s with another hallucinogen, LSD, with terminal cancer patients. And at that time, researchers found that when these cancer patients took the drug, they experienced a lot less anxiety and depression. But those studies sort of fell by the wayside and they weren't really continued upon. And thanks to this new research, experts are saying that it might be time to pick up where these studies from the 1960s left off and consider trials where terminal cancer patients are given hallucinogenic substances as a way to help them perhaps better cope with their condition and even perhaps even change their perception of death. And experts say that this could potentially be a better way of treating these patients than giving them sedatives and narcotics, which just dull the pain but don't necessarily alter their mental outlook.
Well, from the potentially positive impacts of hallucinogens on the brain to the neurobiology of grief. I always thought of grief as a necessary thing. Why is it negative?
Well, grief has been associated with what you might call the negative parts of the brain. Patients who are under fMRI, which is a method that measures blood flow to various parts of the brain, the fMRI shows activity in regions of the brain associated with processing pain, as you might expect. But not all people grieve in the same way. Some people will grieve the loss of the loved one over weeks or even months, but others really never get over the loss of somebody close to them. And these people are known as complicated grievers. And a group of researchers wanted to see, is there something different that happens in the brain of complicated grievers versus non-complicated grievers?
So the fMRI was able to tell them something?
Right. This new study looked at 23 women who had recently lost a mother or a sister to breast cancer. And based on a clinical assessment, they were divided into complicated and non-complicated grievers. And then they were put in an fMRI machine, and they showed the women a series of 60 pictures. Some of the pictures were pictures of the relatives who had passed away, and some were pictures of complete strangers. And as expected, when all the women saw pictures of relatives, these grief-related regions of the brain lit up these pain processing areas. And when they were shown the pictures of the strangers, the grief areas didn't light up. But what was interesting is that the women that had been diagnosed as complicated grievers also showed activity in a region of the brain known as the nucleus accumbens. And this is a region linked to pleasure and reward.
So the women were feeling some sort of pleasure at grieving, these complicated grievers.
Well, it's complicated, but what we do know is that when we form attachments to people, we experience activity in this nucleus accumbens region of the brain. And so the researchers speculate that women who have complicated grief and are also showing activity in this area, their brains just haven't fully adjusted to the idea that their loved ones are gone. And that may explain why they have a harder time letting go than, say, women who don't have activity in this region of the brain.
So for now, this is just sort of another way of telling which person might have complicated grief versus regular grief.
Right. One of the real upshots of this research is that now scientists actually have a physiological marker they can look for. So instead of doing a clinical evaluation to figure out if somebody has complicated versus non-complicated grief, you might just be able to do an fMRI. And Rob, one of the really interesting things here is that grief is such a common emotion. I mean, we all experience it at one time or another, but it's so poorly understood. And this study highlights that even though we're making progress, there's still so much more to understand.
From a hard-to-understand emotion to a hard-to-understand planet. Rain on Mars, the dry, dusty, red planet? When?
Well, Rob, the perennial mystery with Mars is, was it wet in the past? How wet was it? And does it have any implications for the future of our own planet? And for decades now, we've been sending probes to Mars to figure out, can we find evidence of water? And more importantly, can we find evidence of life? And the closest these probes have come so far is the few landers have found evidence of mineral salts, which usually form in the presence of water. So that was sort of an indirect indication that there used to be water on the red planet. And more recently, we've got the Phoenix lander on Mars right now. And just in the last couple of weeks, Phoenix has actually dug into solid water ice on Mars, indicating that now we know for sure that there is water ice on Mars. And that's potentially another clue to a Mars that was wet in the ancient past.
Well, water ice is not a wet or rainy Mars. Why wet or rainy?
Well, the evidence for a past rainy Mars in this study comes from samples that have been taken over the last few decades, those samples I referred to that were collected by various landers. And so when the researchers reanalyzed these samples from the past few decades, they were struck by a distinctive pattern of mineral salt deposits.
And that's consistent with rain?
Right. Well, at least on Earth, in arid regions such as the dry valleys of Antarctica, which have often been used as a comparison to what Mars is like today, and also in certain Chilean deserts, when it rains, you see a very similar pattern. So what this indicates is that sometime in the past, and the researchers speculate probably about 3 billion years ago, there were areas of Mars that were very dry, but that also had light amounts of rainfall. And so what experts are saying is that this work provides further chemical support for the idea that liquid water existed on the surface of Mars for geologically significant periods of time.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for science now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about why our solar system is lopsided, how global warming will turn all animals of a specific species of reptile into males, and finally, we're going to listen to Antarctic ice in the process of breaking. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the July 4th, 2008 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.